Good afternoon. In this introduction, I'm not going to go through the long list of accomplishments and degrees and other accomplishments that Stephen, you know, that he has to his credit, because you've already had a chance to read that. So when I talked with Stephen about, what would you like the audience to know about you in advance of your lecture, he sent me the following, which I will read. He says, since my last lecture in Naples, I was in the Egyptian uprising, January 2011, the Battle of the People's Assembly in Egypt, December 2011, and the Gezi Park protests in Turkey in June of 2013, which means that I have inhaled more tear gas than anyone else here. I'm really very pleased to present to you again Dr. Stephen Cook from the Council on Foreign Relations, and the topic of his lecture is Turkey, Back to the Future, the New Ottoman Empire. Thank you.
What I wanted to do this afternoon was take a little bit of time to look at the past so that we can gain a little bit of traction on what might be happening in the Middle East. And as Earl related, I've completely out of innocence walked into some rather interesting situations in the Middle East over the course of the last 3 years. And I have firsthand knowledge of really the major kinds of changes that are happening in the region. I think that we are looking at a major historical shift. And if you'll bear with me, for the first part of my talk, I'll talk a little bit about the broader Middle East and then bring it back to this idea of a new Ottoman Empire or new Ottomanism. But before I get into it, I just want to pose a question. Do you think that 2013 is 1550, 1916, or 1922? I asked those questions for very specific reasons, and hopefully we can all come to a conclusion by the end of my talk in the Q&A. But let me start out with three personal stories. As Earl was nice enough to mention, I was in the Egyptian uprising of January 25th. I was there for the first 4 days of it. I had not planned to be there. I had actually finished the first draft of my book, The Struggle for Egypt, on January 20th, and put my feet up on my desk, relaxed, had a glass of wine, and a few days later went off to Egypt on some other business, and 3 days later, wouldn't you know, I found myself in Tahrir Square with, at the time, a relatively small crowd of people, only about 25 to 30,000 people. Now, that sounds really big, but when you think about it, the height of the uprising, the first uprising in Egypt, Tahrir Square was accommodating 250,000 people and many millions more in the streets of Egypt. The most recent uprising in Egypt, the June 30, 2013 uprising, had many, many millions and millions of people in the streets. So 25 to 30,000 people there was relatively small. But what was striking to me at that time, and I had planned to stay for as long as it went on, but my wife wouldn't let me. She made me come home. She said, she really played on it. She said, picking up on a theme that Earl started with here, that I'm not so young anymore, and whatever might happen to me in Tahrir, she would do far worse if I decided to stay. But anyway, in the first 4 days, and then she really stuck the knife, and she said, you have two little girls at home who need you. Which is true. What was profound to me was the outpouring of Egyptians who were not there because of economic grievances. You may have heard a lot of this when you flipped on the TV at the time or listened to NPR at the time, that Egyptians were in the streets demanding change because of economic grievances. This was not true. What they were there for was freedom, democracy, accountability, freedom from the brutality of an authoritarian regime, the desire to live in a more open and democratic society, all those kind of things that make us feel all warm and fuzzy when we go to sleep at night. That was an extraordinary, extraordinary moment. Fast forward from February 2013 to October of this year. And I go to Iraq, and specifically I go to northern Iraq, to the Kurdistan region of the country, and visit the Kurdish capital of Iraq, Erbil, and the cultural capital of Kurdistan, in Soleimania. And throughout my visit there, I ask each and every person that I meet, young, old, from different parts of Kurdistan, so what is it that binds you to the people in Basra? What national idea connects you to them? And to a person, man, woman, child, young, the young who speak no Arabic, only English or a Kurdish dialect, old who speak pretty good Arabic and dialects of Kurdish, to a person I met in Kurdistan during this recent visit said, nothing binds me to the people in Basra. Nothing binds me to the people of Baghdad. I do not feel Iraqi. I feel Kurdish. And then finally, the next personal story that I want you to think about as I'm speaking is, I have a dear friend who is a Jordanian, a very, very talented and bright young woman who comes from perhaps the most important tribe in Jordan, and this tribe spans both Jordanian as well as Syrian territory. So it's not just the largest tribe in Jordan, it's the largest tribe in Jordan and Syria. And she's just returned to the United States after finishing her PhD at Oxford, at St. Anthony's College in Oxford. And she called me, she said, hey, I'm back in town, let's get together for lunch and let's talk about and solve the Middle East. And she surprised me. Nadia surprised me. She's a very strong activist at the leading edge of young people who want to see a more democratic and open and just future for the Middle East. And what she said to me was, we need Syria, but not post-World War I Syria. We need something resembling the Syrian province of the Ottoman Empire. We need to break down those borders between Syria and Jordan. We need, she said, set aside Lebanon, set aside Israel. We need to do our best to recreate that Syrian province of the Ottoman Empire, because that's the only way, to her mind, of resolving the horrific civil war in Syria, which is breaking up the country anyway, and the only way to resolve the political problems that she perceives are happening in the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan. I think these stories are evocative of the fact that on January 14th, 2011, the day that the Tunisian dictator Zine Abidine Ben Ali left Tunisia in disgrace after a month-long uprising in this country, that on that day, January 14, 2011, and then 11 days later, when Egyptians rose up against Hosni Mubarak and against all odds brought him down, you do not bring down a pharaoh, you build a pyramid to pharaohs. That is when the 20th century ended in the Middle East. And the question is, what does the 21st century look like? Does it look like the 16th century? Does it look like 1916? Does it look like 1922? After Mubarak fell in particular, let's set aside Tunisia. Tunisia was extraordinary for starting this process. But Tunisia is basically the size of Florida, and Florida has more international influence than Syria. But once Hosni Mubarak came down in Egypt, a revolutionary bandwagon began throughout the region. It spread to Libya. It spread to Yemen. It spread to Oman. It spread to Bahrain. And of course, by the late spring of 2011, it had spread to Syria. Even as states like Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Algeria, and Morocco have sought to insulate themselves in a variety of ways from this revolutionary bandwagon, from the political turbulence of the region, the ferment is affecting them. How could it not affect them? How could these major changes, how could the end of a political order that has lasted for the better part of 100 years not affect even those countries that have not experienced uprising and political turbulence? As I said, we are witnessing the end of a political order that lasted about 91 years. What will the future hold in the region? What comes next? Well, it's become fashionable in Washington, D.C., where I spend the vast majority of my time, and elsewhere, to declare Sykes-Picot dead. Sykes-Picot dead. Well, since many people haven't thought about Sykes-Picot for about 90 years, let's remind ourselves what we're talking about when people say Sykes-Picot dead. Of course, Sir Mark Sykes is dead, as is François-Georges Picot. They're both dead. But their agreement, in the minds of many people, only recently died in the Middle East. Of course, the guy left out of this agreement was Sergei Sazonov, the Russian foreign minister at the time, but we'll put that aside. These three men hatched a plan during World War I about how to divide up the region after the war was over. This was about the division, who got the spoils of the region. And it really was not an agreement amongst each other. In the process of negotiating, they tried to prevent each other from getting the best or outmaneuvering the other in terms of territories, mineral resources, etc. Yet the problem with this argument about the end of Sykes-Picot that has taken over Washington, you see it in opinion magazines, op-ed columns, virtually every talk that someone gives about the future trajectory of the Middle East, is that for all intents and purposes, the Sykes-Picot Agreement actually died during World War I, and certainly by World War II, when the British, they became the dominant power in the region, finally retrenched and rationalized their position in an extraordinarily restive Middle East. Sounds kind of familiar. A country that is the dominant power in the region, to some extent overextended, spend too much time in that region, needing to retrench, rationalize its position in the region in the face of extraordinarily restive Middle East, seeks to retrench. Still, pardon me, what people mean when they talk about the end of Sykes-Picot is that the end of, what they're talking about is the end of the state in the Middle East. Can we, after 3 years of brutal civil war in Syria, talk about Syria in the way in which we have come to know Syria, way we've come to think about Syria? Perhaps my friend Nadia is right. We need the Syrian province of the Ottoman Empire to rescue us from this awful civil war. Can we think about Iraq in the same way that we thought about Iraq since the end of World War I? I don't think that we can. I don't think it's possible to think about Iraq in that way when you consider the fact that the Kurds don't even think of themselves as Iraqi and have essentially become independent under the noses of the international community. If Syria fails, for the lack of a better term, if Iraq rips itself apart, what then could we say about Jordan's future? There are extraordinary historical changes that are coming in this part of the world. There are only a few countries in the region that are actual states with historical weight and, it seems, staying power. Egypt, Turkey, Iran. You might want to include Israel into that category, but in its modern form, it is also a product of the time in which Syria, Iraq, and Jordan and other countries were established. The implications of this stress is that we are at a major historical point in the Middle East. Will there be a rationalization of sects and ethnicities in the regions? Will Sunnis, Shiites, Kurds, Alawites separate? Will they create their own allegedly rational states or statelets? Kurds will likely become independent, as I said before. They already are. Kurds have everything that they need to be independent other than their own money and a flag at the United Nations. But they have plenty of their own flags flying everywhere else. And that's something unique to Kurdistan. Kurdistan was stuck onto Iraq in 1925, 4 years after Iraq was actually established, and it was never incorporated into the country in a way that made sense to Kurds. That's why when you ask Kurds, Do you feel Iraqi? What is that national idea that binds you to Iraq? And they say, no, I don't feel Iraqi, and there is no national idea. All this makes a lot of sense. People are starting to think about, what does the breakup of Syria look like? What does the breakup of Iraq look like? Yet the scenario of regional fragmentation in a way that creates more rational states along ethnic and sectarian lines seems like yet something hatched in a foreign ministry somewhere rather than the actual realities on the ground. In the way that Sykes-Picot was hatched in London and Paris and Moscow, this idea about the rationalization of the region along separate sectarian and ethnic lines seems somewhat artificial. The fight in Syria is about Syria, about this country called Syria. The fight in Iraq is over Iraq. It's true that they are colonial creations, but these colonial creations now, 9 decades later, almost a century later, actually have meanings. Borders have been institutionalized. There is a sense of Syrianness, a sense of Iraqiness, not among Kurds, but certainly among Sunni and Shia Arabs. It may take a very long time to work out the political arrangements, but the colonial creations, as I said, have meaning and will endure, which suggests that without some ordering power in the region, we're in for significant violence, instability, a return to authoritarianism and reason. The result is generalized instability like we have not seen before. Everybody always used to talk about the instability in the Middle East. Where was this instability? Hosni Mubarak led Egypt for 30 years. Ben Ali led Tunisia for 35, or was it 28? I get them confused. They've been on the thrones for so long. These regimes were stable. Now they are no longer stable. So the question is, will some power within the region or outside the region order it? Provide the rules of the road, the economic incentives, economic development, political leadership, diplomatic support, and importantly, military power to establish a new regional order. And in addition to this meme about Sykes-Picot being dead, in Washington and other world capitals, people are talking about the Turkish model. The rise of the new Ottomans, that Turkey can play this role in a region by stepping forward, not necessarily taking place of an exhausted United States, but taking a leadership role in the region. There was a time when Turks themselves believed that in a virtual sense, they could, if not actually recreate the Ottoman Empire, I mean, that's only in the fantasy minds of very few people, they couldn't recreate the golden era of the Ottoman power in the region. They could foster Turkish leadership, a new Ottoman era of Turkish political and economic power that would, as I said, order the region. The current Turkish leadership, which comes from an Islamist background and venerates the Ottoman era, seemed perfectly placed to do this kind of thing, and perfectly placed, especially after the Arab uprisings, to play this leadership role in the region. Just as an aside, I was in Cairo in September 2011 when Prime Minister Erdogan, the leader of Turkey, arrived in Cairo to a hero's welcome. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people came out in the streets to welcome Tayyip Erdogan to the new Egypt. This was, according to Turkish interlocutors, a function of Turkish cultural affinity, a common shared history with the region, and in particular, the country's successes over the course of the last decade. Turkey had become a politically liberalizing, an economically successful country that could be a model for the Middle East, for the Arab world. Even before the uprisings, people were talking about this. And in fact, Prime Minister Erdogan fashioned himself as the king of the Arab street, with vocal denunciation of Israeli policy in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, taking on American and Israeli and Egyptian and Saudi truths in the region to speak truth to power, to speak over the leaders of this political order that had existed in the region, that had been basically friendly to the exercise of American power in the region, speaking over those leaders to the people of the region, to the point where poll after poll after poll in the mid-2000s made Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan, a Turk, a non-Arab, the most respected leader in the Arab world. Anybody know prior to that who was the most respected leader in the Arab world? Show of hands. I know this is the one of the pre-interactive portion of our program. Anybody? Anybody? Over and over, with the exception of 2006, when it was Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the former president of Iran, coming on the heels of Israel, the war between Israel and Lebanon during that summer, consistently, it was Jacques Chirac of France, which always surprised me. It always surprised me that the French somehow get a pass in the Middle East. They were this terrible colonial power. They gave the Israelis the arms necessary to win the 1967 war and built the Israeli nuclear program. Yet, nevertheless, the French always got a pass. Never understood it. That's a plug for freedom fries and freedom toast. Anyway, there was this sense that Ankara, that Turkey, would be the natural leader of the Middle East. All of these things would combine together that would allow Turkey to be an engine of economic growth, to help with political soft landings, and to essentially write the rules of the road and the rules of the game in the Middle East. This made a tremendous amount of sense to a lot of people in the Middle East, mostly Turks, but some Arabs as well, who did acknowledge that Turkey was a model. My friend Nadia, after the uprisings began, said, yes, what does Iran have to offer me? What does Saudi Arabia have to offer me? Nothing. But Turkey has something to offer me. I look to Turkey, it has something to offer me. As smart as many of these people were, as heady that moment was, all of these ideas about Turkey leading the region were largely superficial. The Turks, in particular, exaggerated their own insight into the Middle East. Not only had they built this mystique, Prime Minister Erdogan built this mystique on beating up the Israelis on their policies with regard to the Palestinians, which was always going to garner him a significant amount of support, but it was also built on the fact that very early on in the Egyptian uprising, Prime Minister Erdogan called for, before any other world leader, called for Hosni Mubarak to listen to his people and step aside. Wow, this seemed like this guy Erdogan and the Turks really understood actually what was happening. But what was this born of? This was born of the fact that Erdogan and Mubarak were like oil and water. These guys hated each other. Mubarak resented the fact that this Turkish interloper was playing in Arab affairs, especially Egyptian affairs, when it came to the Palestinians. The cultural affinity between Turkey and the Arab world was overplayed. Yes, there was a sense of kind of common Muslimness, but Turkey's primary foreign policy vocation was to the West. Turkey had been looking to the West. The entire project of Ataturk, Mustafa Kemal, the founder of the Republic of Turkey, was to raise Turkey to the level of civilization. And what he meant by civilization, he meant Western civilization. There was in as much of a cultural and historical affinity between Turkey and the Arab world, primarily because as a result of Ataturk's reforms, Turkey had turned its back on its former colonial dominions, and because of Ataturk's radical secularizing reforms, in fact, to the point where he changed the alphabet, most Turks post a generation or two that lived after the founding of the Republic in 1923 had no access to their own history because they don't read this Ottoman Turkish. This was all kind of conjured, a public relations game that the Turks were playing. They also downplayed the colonial history of the Ottoman Empire in the Arab world. I have friends in the Arab world, people who are many of them your age, who remember their grandfathers being taken from them and killed in Anatolia by Ottoman forces. There isn't that kind of affinity in the way in which many have imagined. And of course, Turks also overplayed their soft power in the region. For 2 years, every time I went to Turkey, I had to hear about the fact that Egyptians and other Arabs were watching Turkish soap operas. This was somehow a signal that Turkey was an unrivaled power in the region, that its time had come to return to the Middle East as a power. I'm a nice guy, but I'm not that nice. So I always had to remind them that I had spent some time living in Egypt. And not only were the Egyptians watching Turkish soap operas, but they were also watching Mexican soap operas. So was Mexico going to lead the Middle East? Like I said, I'm nice, but not that nice. They also exaggerated their own economic importance. Certainly, Turkey can be, and perhaps its lasting legacy in the region. It may not be the rise of the new Ottomans. We may not be talking about the new Ottoman era, but certainly their economic power and strength can be a lasting legacy in the region, but they themselves have their own problems. This is an emerging economy that is subject to the policy decisions of the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States. What Ben Bernanke, or maybe soon Janet Yellen, does in Washington will have a profound effect on the Turkish economy. Easy money, pumping billions of dollars into the global economy, have been a boon to the Turks. It'll be interesting to see what happens to Turkey when that easy money comes to an end, as it likely will. And then finally, I think the nail in the coffin of this idea about a new Ottomanism, Turkey leading the region, was this past summer. As Earl mentioned, my little funny story about inhaling too much tear gas. Of all the tear gas that I've inhaled, Turkish tear gas is perhaps the worst. There's something about it. I don't know. It has a profound effect. It is pretty harsh stuff. That you cannot claim to be a liberalizing, democratizing power that is a model or an inspiration for an Arab world that is struggling to build more open and just societies if you are using the tactics perfected by deposed Arab dictators. And I'm not just talking about tear gas. I'm not just talking about rubber bullets. I'm not just talking about water cannon. By the way, the water cannon was probably worse than the tear gas. It scared me more than anything else because they put pepper spray in the water cannon. So when it hits your skin, it burns like crazy. I did not, thankfully, have to suffer through that, but I know people who did. But it wasn't just that. It's the fact that the Turks have created for themselves their own virtual ministry of information dedicated to sending out the message and only the message of the ruling Justice and Development Party. They haven't done it by actually establishing a ministry, but they have used their electoral success and their power to intimidate journalists, to force owners of more independent media companies to sell to friends of the ruling party. It's created a chill. They have put a tremendous amount of pressure on civil society organizations and international NGOs at work in Turkey. All of these tactics are positively Mubarak-esque. It is hard to lead a region that is struggling to be more democratic. Remember, when I was in Tahrir Square, people weren't necessarily asking for bread. They were asking for freedom. They were asking for democracy. What kind of model can you be if you are using the tactics, as I said, of deposed dictators? The question is, if not the Turks, then who? If not the Turks, then who? Turkey has bad relations with Saudi Arabia, with Qatar, with Egypt, with Israel, with all the regional powers. So it can't possibly be Turkey that will do this. Who will it be? Well, there's been some discussion of a Saudi era in the Middle East. Can the Saudis, with all of their rials, I'm sure you've all heard of realpolitik. Well, this is realpolitik, R-I-Y-A-L politik. But can the Saudis buy off the rest of the region? Do they have the resources? Saudi Arabia is a country of major contradictions. We think of Saudi Arabia as this extraordinarily wealthy country, and it is. But its streets are not lined with gold. There are desperately poor people in Saudi Arabia. The Saudis, to this point, have been able to buy political quiescence. But just buying political quiescence is not enough. You have to have a vision for the future. We have to look at the way in which these leaders rule their own countries. And the Saudis have a lot of money, a lot of coercion, and a little bit of vision. It strikes me that they don't have enough of vision to lead their people and lead the region. They can only buy off people for so long. Right now, the Egyptians are happy to take Saudi money along with Emirati and Kuwaiti money. But there will come a time when the Egyptians will want to resist the soft conditions of Saudi financing. Is it a Qatar era? The little country that could. A country, more interaction. Earl, do you have a brother? All right. Earl, imagine you and your brother owned a country. Okay? And imagine further that you had 125,000 cousins. Are you imagining? And imagine at the end of each fiscal year, you cut a check to the tune of $160,000 each to every one of your 125,000 cousins. I just described Qatar in terms of Earl. Earl is the emir of Qatar now. This is a country with extraordinary resources, but not many people, and as a result, has sought to use those resources to influence the region. In 1996, Al Jazeera was launched, shook the Arab world, became the voice of the Arab people. Shortly after that, Al Jazeera English launched. And now this year we have Al Jazeera America. In addition, the emir, not the current one, the previous one, built the biggest air base in the world for the U.S. Central Command. Let me tell you something. If you want to ensure your longevity on the throne, the best thing you can do is build a runway that David Petraeus cannot see the end of. Because that will keep us there, and we'll say, the Qatari ruling family, strategic asset of the United States. But the question is, how much can the Qataris do to advance their influence? 1996 through the mid-2000s, up until just a short period of time, they used Al Jazeera with tremendous deft. They used their ability to marshal their own money with tremendous deft in the region. So people started to wonder, can a country of 125,000 people, owned by a guy and his brother, with 500,000 people who make it run for the rest of them, can that country lead the region? Is this the little country that could? And then a funny thing happened. After the Arab uprisings, the Qataris decided that they were going to buy themselves influence throughout the Middle East. They were going to support Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood. They were going to support President Mohamed Morsi of Egypt. They were going to support certain groups in Libya. They were going to support certain groups in the Syrian civil war. And guess what? Over the course of a year, Egyptians decided they didn't like Mohamed Morsi very much. He was a dictator. He wanted to change their lifestyles. This was not good for Egypt. And there was another uprising. And the Qataris essentially were hung by their own petard. Hung by their own petard. Caught completely unawares, to the point where Egypt, the largest media market in the entire Middle East, Al Jazeera viewership is way, way, way down. In the uprising of June 30th, Egyptians, guess what? They burned the American flag. I'm yawning. I've seen it a million times. They burned the Israeli flag. I'm yawning. I've seen it a zillion times. But you know what other flag they burned? They burn the Qatari flag. The same thing has happened in Libya. The same thing has happened in a variety of other places. The Qatar is clearly can't do it. Will it be an Egyptian era? Well, if it's going to be an Egyptian era, the people are going to have to wait a very, very, very long time. Because although Egypt has staying power, Egypt is engaged in a long-term struggle to define what Egypt is. It is not a coincidence that I called my book The Struggle for Egypt. And it's not a coincidence that I didn't start my book on January 25th, 2011, but actually in 1882. Now, that sounds really boring, but it's not, I promise. So you should get it. I have kids to send to camp, and you know how expensive camp is these days? It's shocking to me, absolutely shocking. But Egypt is in this period of turmoil that is likely to last for a very long time. We may get some semblance of stability in Egypt, but that does not diminish the fact that Egyptians will continue to fight for a different future as they ask themselves what kind of society they want, what kind of government they want, what is the relationship between religion and state, what does it mean to be Egypt, what is Egypt's place in the region and the world. These are all questions that Egyptians have been asking for the better part of the last century, and nobody's answered them. So you can see how some version of what we're seeing over the course of the last 3 years is going to continue. Is it an Iranian era? I think not. The Iranians have enabled the killing of hundreds of thousands of people in Syria. Iran is Persian and Shia. It's unlikely that Arab Sunni will submit to Iranian power. And in fact, although the Israelis get all of the press in trying to convince and cajole the United States to take a tougher stand on Iran, if you go and you talk to the Saudi ambassador in Washington, you blink your eyes and you say, I'm sorry, am I in the Saudi embassy or the Israeli embassy? And then you go across town and you go to the Israeli embassy and you sit with the Israeli ambassador and he's talking about Iran and you blink and you say, I'm sorry, am I in the Israeli embassy or am I in the Saudi embassy? These guys are not going to submit to Iranian power as much as the Iranians want to believe that they have a natural right as a great civilization to be influential in the region. I remember a couple of years ago I was in Kuwait, and I was talking to the Kuwaitis, and they said, of course it's the clerical regime in Iran. Of course it's the clerical regime in Iran. But it's deeper than that. It is Iran. There is a continuity in Iranian foreign policy that wants to influence the region. What do we think the Shah wanted to do? He wanted to be the regional policeman. This suggests that if we're not going to have a resurgent, a new Ottoman era, if none of the actors in the region have the capacity to lead the region, I have news for you. I have news for you. You know who the new boss in the Middle East is going to be? Same as the old boss, the United States. There are obviously structural and political problems associated with the United States playing the predominant role in the region that it has played over the course of the last 20 years, since Operation Desert Storm. We were a dominant power in the region post-World War II, but we were the predominant, the only power in the region after Operation Desert Storm. And as I said, there are structural and political problems with it. How long do Americans want to be involved in the Middle East? A region where we are less and less dependent on its energy resources. As surely as the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, we will want to help ensure Israeli security. But Israelis don't really want us in the Middle East. With us in the Middle East, it narrows their room for maneuver. It's good enough that we provide diplomatic, political, and military support for the Israelis to protect themselves. That's always been the case. Americans don't want to be there. Arabs don't really want us there. I'm talking about your average Arabs don't really want us there. And we are less dependent on the region. Yet nevertheless, without the exercise of American power, this region is going to be, as I said, a major source of instability and violence and authoritarianism. The question then is, how does the United States order the region in a way that's rational for the next 30 years? We know what we've done the last 20 years and the 10 years before that. You know, a lot of people have faulted the Obama administration for very many things related to the Middle East. But what they fail to understand is that the Middle East is actually pretty hard. It's pretty hard. These are unprecedented historical changes. This is not 1989. This is not 1550. It's not 1916. I'd say it's probably closer to 1922, when the British, confronted with a restive region, limited resources, actually did something strategic. You know, the word strategic has become a synonym for important, but that's not actually what it means. Strategy means defining what your goals are and matching your national resources in order to achieve those goals. What you can fault the Obama administration for is that we have had this kind of historical change underway now for 3 years. Okay, give them 6, 7, 8, 9 months to finally dawn on them. Wow, this is something really big. So then let's say 2.5 years to think, to be creative and think about how we rationalize our place in the Middle East so that we can be there in ways different than the way we've been over the course of the 20 years and free up resources to do other important things in the world. Tend to our relationship with China. Tend to our relationship with India, Brazil. Think about how to deal with global climate change. All kinds of big strategic issues that are facing the United States. I applaud the administration for thinking that they need to have a lighter touch, but they haven't figured out exactly how to do that. How to define what our national goals are, and how to marshal the resources to meet those goals. I'm afraid to say that we are going to be in an extraordinary debate about foreign policy going forward. It is not a foregone conclusion that we will stay in the region. It is not a foregone conclusion that we can order the region, particularly given the politics in the region. It is not a foregone conclusion that countries in the region want us, particularly given or believe that we can support them in the way in which they want, considering our dysfunctional politics here at home. And this is very serious, the return of two very strong strains of isolationism on both the right and the left in this country, which, I should say, as an aside, makes the work of the World Affairs Council that much more important in this era when Americans are tired of the Middle East, are less dependent on the Middle East, and don't feel that they have the resources available to be productive and constructive in the Middle East. Let me close, and I'm really looking forward to Q&A. I think that I've raised a number of rather sensitive issues during this talk, but let me close because Earl and I were talking in the car. I will roll with Earl to the wheels fall off. Earl and I have really had a meeting of the minds over the course of the last couple of days, and he said to me, "You know, is there something positive here?" I said, to paraphrase, it really bums me out. We hear these talks and there's no good news. Well, let me end on a little bit of good news just for you, Earl. Taken all together, all of the problems in the region, the bloodshed, the turmoil, the hatred, the differences between Sunni, Shia, literally the coming apart of countries in the region, there's one thing that I always, always hold on to. And if it bums Earl out, you can imagine me. I work on this stuff all day long. I need to find things to make myself feel better at the end of the day. My daughter is not what you're all thinking. I knew it. And perhaps it's the romance of the barricades. Perhaps it was that brief moment in Tahrir Square at the beginning of the Egyptian uprising. But it still gets to me. When I think about those moments where there were young Egyptians, my age and younger, who were demanding democracy, freedom, the equal application of law, accountability, a mechanism to hold their leaders accountable. That these ideas that are associated with us, with Western liberal democracies, are what so many people in this part of the world want, and what ultimately at base they are fighting for and fighting against. They're fighting against dark forces in order to get this. If the Middle East ends up being a zone of renewed authoritarianism, renewed instability, and bloodshed, it's not because people in this part of the world don't want to live in democracies. It's not because Arabs can't live in democracies. It's not because Muslims can't live in democracies, that they're somehow the idea that Islam and democracy don't mix. It's because of the overhang of the old order fighting to stay alive, those counter-revolutionary forces that are trying to thwart this sunnier future for the region. And still, knowing that this is happening, young Arabs, young Turks, are out there, and they are demanding, at great risk, their freedoms. And we should honor that. We should look upon it with humility, but we should honor it with our own values and speak out on their behalf. I'll end there. Thank you so much.
The microphones are set up in the back. We'll start over here, and then we'll alternate back and forth. So you're first.
One of the aspects following the uprisings in the Middle East and North Africa has been the tension between secularists and Islamists in terms of how those countries should be governed, I think in particular Tunisia and Egypt. That issue has also been alive in Turkey over the last decade or so. What is the state of the issue between secularists and Islamists currently, and where do you see that heading?
Conflictual, and it will likely continue to be conflictual. It is not, though, as stark as that. There are actually shades of nuance, shades of gray and nuance in these stories. The Justice and Development Party in Turkey, for example, came to power riding a coalition that included large numbers of secularists and then was reelected in 2007 with even broader coalition that included larger numbers of secularists, and reelected again in June 2011 that included an even bigger coalition that included larger numbers of secularists. But when Prime Minister Erdogan and the Justice and Development Party demonstrated a U-turn in Turkish politics. Now let's separate for a second liberals and Democrats. Liberals and secularists, I should say. For the liberals, that illiberal turn in politics, the use of authoritarian means, was a major problem, and they broke from the Justice and Development Party. For the secularists, the idea, secularists and liberals, not the same thing. In fact, there are quite a few fascist secularists, but the idea that the Justice and Development Party would alter their lifestyles through the Islamization of political institutions was also a reason to oppose them. Even though they have split, there still are large numbers of Turks, a rising middle class, pious and not pious, who feel richer, better off than they were before the Justice and Development Party came to power. And they continue to support Erdogan. And the other important thing about Turkey is that the Justice and Development Party allowed, for the first time, Turks, 99.8% of the Turkish population is Muslim, allowed Turks to explore their Muslim identities in ways that are safe. Previously, it wasn't so safe to wear hijab in public. You certainly couldn't go into certain public places wearing the hijab. There is a law of the hat in Turkey that is designed to prevent people from wearing religious garb and outwardly expressing their religious identity. The Justice and Development Party changed that, and lots of people happened to like that. Now, in Egypt, there was a similar, very brief moment where liberals and secularists signed up with Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood based on Morsi's promises that he would uphold the principles of the revolution and that he wouldn't impinge on the secular lifestyle. Well, he violated both of those things very quickly, and they broke with him. And these relations are seen now as much more conflictual going forward.
Having just returned from Turkey, we gained some impressions there, and I'd like to get your thoughts on them. First of all, that he's a very clever politician and will be reelected in the next election. Secondly, that there are more journalists in jail in Turkey than in any other country. That he was a man of modest means and is now the richest man in the country. Stories like that, and I wonder if you could comment if those are valid or if that's just part of the opposition speaking loudly.
Prime Minister Erdogan is, I think, next to Bill Clinton, the best politician I have ever seen. He is extraordinary. I was once in a small group of non-Turkish speaking New Yorkers, and he doesn't speak a lot of English. And I thought these people were going to devote the rest of their lives to him. That's how charismatic he can be. So if he is charismatic with a bunch of Upper East Siders who don't speak Turkish, imagine what he is like with your average Turk. Plus, this is a guy who doesn't come from the elite. He comes from Kasim Pasha. Did you go to Kasim Pasha when you're in Istanbul? It is literally down a steep hill from Taksim Square, the kind of secular heart of New Istanbul. And he has literally and figuratively worked his way up because he has that something. He knows what makes Turks tick. And even with all the problems that he has encountered, he remains the single most important Turkish politician, not only of his generation, but since Ataturk. Even more so than Turgut Özal. There are more journalists in jail in Turkey than in Iran and China. But that is an indictment of Turkey, but that doesn't mean that Turkey is more closed than China or Iran. But it is an indictment. This stuff about Erdogan being well, I put it in the same category as Hosni Mubarak. Nobody really knows. He's definitely wealthier than he was before he became the prime minister. But nobody really knows. I would take anybody who says Tayyip Erdogan is worth $66.335 billion with a grain of salt.
Okay, last question over here.
Islam is a religion, but I also seem, from what I've been reading, that it's also a political force. Do you ever see a true democratic Western-style government in the Mideast, with the strong influence of Islam, whether it's Shiism or Sunniism, where you would truly have a separation of state and government?
Essentially, what you're asking me is, there can Islam and democracy coexist? Let me start out by saying that there are democracies in the Muslim world. Indonesia, Malaysia, they're not perfect, but they are democracies. The second largest Muslim country in the world is also the largest democracy in the world. Does anybody know what country I'm talking about? India. So there isn't something about Islam and democracy. The problem, there is an Arab exception. There is no doubt. You're absolutely right. What Arab country can we call a democracy? We can't. But this isn't a function of culture. It's not a function of religion. You're absolutely right. There is in Islam no rendering unto Caesar what Caesar's and rendering unto God what is God. It's all God. And some of the darkest interpretations of Islam say that there can be nothing but God's sovereignty on earth. And that's where we get extremism of the variety of Al-Qaeda. that has this kind of cosmic view of the world. Doug, you're killing me. This cosmic view of the world in which they will recreate the caliphate. But the problem in Egypt, the problem in Tunisia, the problem in other parts of the world is good old-fashioned authoritarianism. There were no revolutions in the Arab world. I know people talk about the Egyptian revolution, the Tunisian revolution. No, there were uprisings, there were rebellions. And what that means is that whereas in revolutions, the political institutions of society are swept away and the social institutions of society are swept away, that in a place like Egypt, for example, the political institutions of the old order remained. And the way of doing things in the old order remained. Institutions are not places with offices and coffee makers. Institutions are rules, they're laws, they're decrees. In an informal sense, they're the way things have always been done. They're uncodified norms. So those things that were so important to the old order lived on despite the fact that Hosni Mubarak was in Sharm el-Sheikh and then subsequently in jail. And that continued to shape the way in which people went about their business and sought political power. At the same time that this political order was still hanging on, these countries are at this odd interregnum that you have the old order that's hanging on and forces that support the old order trying to make sure that the new order is the old order, forces, revolutionary forces that are trying to overthrow it, continually trying to overthrow it. And it's at that interaction, at that relationship, where you get the instability, you get the violence, you get this wildly contentious type of political environment. But the fact that Egypt, 3 years after Hosni Mubarak's fall, isn't a Jeffersonian democracy on the Nile, my God, it took a millennium and then some after the fall of the Roman Empire in the West for the state system and democracy to take root in Western Europe. 3 years, 36 months since Mubarak fell. So I'm not willing to make a cultural argument. I know there many people are. I think it's a false argument. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everybody.